Online Trading Academy is a leader in investing and stock trading education. Sign up for a class today to learn proven strategies on how to trade smarter. Text Cairo to 57682 and register for a free workshop in Bellevue and other surrounding areas. Text Cairo to 57682.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Hello and welcome. It's Greg Tomlin sitting in for Dory today alongside Zach Burns.
Good afternoon, Greg.
It's our first time hosting a show together, Zach.
Yeah, it should go well.
I'm looking forward to it. We got lots of things to get to, and let's not waste any time. Let's jump right into The Big Lead.
The Big Lead, Dory Monson Show exclusive.
We're joined now by Kelly Sevier and Tommy Tate. They're the parents of Sabrina Tate, who passed away tragically on April 5th in Seattle's last so-called safe zone for people whose home is their vehicles. And while medical examiners are still determining the cause of Sabrina's passing, it's likely that it occurred from complications relating to a leg infection that was the result of drug use. First off, right out the chute here, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your willingness to talk about your daughter and a little bit about your own experiences. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your daughter, Sabrina, a little bit about her upbringing.
Well, she grew up in Spokane and spent the first 16 years of her life in Spokane. Sweet young girl, shy at times, grew up loving animals, had dogs around the house all the time. Grew up with an affinity for music. She played the violin. Was trying to learn how to play the guitar. From the music standpoint, she just loved the grunge music that was coming out through the 90s and so forth, the Seattle scene, but also, newer bands like Good Charlotte and then No Doubt and bands like that. But, she had a good childhood. For the younger years, I know one thing that we shared. I know one thing that we shared with the Seattle Times was that, Kelly and I got divorced in 2003, and Sabrina was 12, 13 at that time. And my observation at the time and even now was, she of our three girls, she took it the hardest, and. That's one thing looking back that I wish I could have done differently, because looking back, hindsight's always 20/20, right? There are a lot of things I could have done and maybe all of us could have done. We're learning from that. We're hurting from that. I know, and Kelly can probably speak a lot to this too, but then as she grew older, she started to have some struggles. Experimented with some drugs. Kelly, I believe it was meth. That was the first thing that we discovered.
Yeah.
And then after some attempted intervention and confrontation, she dropped out of Ferris High School in Spokane and enlisted in the Job Corps program in Moses Lake. And that actually went well for a while. She took on a lot of responsibilities, was sober to the best of my knowledge, went through the ranks there. She was there for 2 to 3 years. By 2009, she was in a position of responsibility, the way the structure set up there, but then she ran into problems. And Kelly might be able to talk a little bit more about that specifically if you'd like, but she walked away from the Job Corps in 2009. And she, at that point, went onto the streets, didn't come home, spent some time on the streets in Spokane. And at some point in that period of time, she decided to go to Seattle shortly after she had gotten arrested here in Spokane with some other people for some vandalism at an RV park. I remember a sheriff's deputy in Spokane had called me and, just some vandalism, but they took him in and brought her belongings to my residence. And in those belongings, I found, among other things, to my horror, hypodermic needles, bottle caps, and things like that. I knew immediately what they were for. When she came by the next day to pick up her belongings after she got released, I asked her about that. I had gotten rid of it, but she swore up and down that it was somebody else's, that that wasn't hers, that she had used before, and it was the guy she was with. But then she had to go. She said she had to go. From my standpoint, that was the last time I saw her in 2010, until this past February at her grandmother's funeral. Kelly can probably fill in some of the blanks there.
Kelly, if you don't mind, if I ask you a question, was that the first time you discovered her having any sort of drug paraphernalia on her? Before then, was it just suspicion that she was using?
Well, yes and no. At that time, before she went into Job Corps, there was one incident where she left home and didn't return for over 24 hours. And we went out looking for her, her sister and I. And we found her across the street from her high school the next morning. And that, to my knowledge, was the first time that she had experimented with methamphetamines. And that was when Tommy talks about the intervention. At that point, that was when, you know, we all got together as a family and talked about, you know, what can we do? And then she went into Job Corps for about 3 years. When she came back from Job Corps, she lived with us. She stayed with us for less than a week and then went over to Seattle to stay with her aunt.
So what
and
did
she
you...
spent the summer...
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to ask.
Oh, no, go ahead.
When you knew that she was possibly in the thralls of addiction, which is such a complicated issue and so devastating, especially from a family member's perspective, what did you both try to do to help her kick the apparent habit that she had developed? What was at your disposal that you thought you could use to potentially help your daughter, and what came from that?
At the point, we thought that our family structure was strong enough that conversation and love would help get us to that solution, and obviously it didn't. And I, at least from my perspective, I will admit I was naive about the services that were out there, and that was probably the best possible moment that we could have changed the course of her future. But my naivety at that time, that just family and church and religion and those kinds of things could be the solution, I was wrong. I regret that. You know, looking back 12 years now, I would have done it completely differently. I know much more about how, the resources you can go out to. Obviously, we've paid that price. I'm sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
Well, no, also at the point of when her addiction, when she actually got into the point of being addicted, she was away from home. She was over 18 and an adult and sporadic. The majority of the time, I had no idea how to reach her unless she was to call me, which was really hard. I didn't know where she was or how to reach her.
Kelly, when you brought up the issue of her addiction, how would she react? Was she just denying everything? Did she get angry?
Yes, both. She told me she didn't have a problem, that she could stop anytime she wanted, and that she wasn't addicted.
It's such a complicated issue, and parents only have so much they can do in that instance because people are self-determining, and you can only extend so much love and so much help to where people ultimately will decide for themselves what they do with their lives at the end of the day, however tragic it might end up. We're speaking with Kelly Sevier and Tommy Tate. Their daughter, Sabrina Tate, died tragically on April 5th in one of Seattle's last so-called safe zones. How did Sabrina end up at this safe zone in Seattle?
Well, to my knowledge, since she's been in Seattle for approximately the past 8 years, she had had friends that she stayed with off and on. There were times, as in approximately 2013, where she did an interview with Invisible People. And at that point, she was staying with a friend, but they were staying under a bridge. How she ended up in the RV park is she was staying with some friends in an RV, and they happened to get housing. And so they left the RV, they sold the RV to her. And that's how she ended up in that particular RV.
Do you think so-called safe zones are really a misnomer? You know, the city is spending millions of dollars on this homeless epidemic here. And do you think safe zones are one of the ways that inch us towards a solution to this problem? Or do you think it helps perpetuate the problem?
You know, last Wednesday we went out to that safe zone. And I was horrified that what I saw, that when Sabrina did talk to us about that safe zone, obviously it was not what she described to me. You know, it's only a safe zone if, first of all, you think if it's protected, meaning some kind of boundaries around it where people can't come and go that don't belong there, some kind of services, running water, outhouses, they're not services, excuse me, a real effort to get housing services for these folks. I know their caseworker was involved, but I'd love to know how much that person's hands were tied to try to get her housing services, whether she was in an RV or not in that safe zone. I mean, that's another concern of mine. But the hour we spent out there last Wednesday, the word safe is not something that ever came to my mind.
Kelly, can you describe specifically what you saw, Kelly?
Well, basically, the safe lot was basically a gravel dirt lot with huge potholes. I honestly don't know how some of the RVs were even able to get in there with the size of the potholes. There was a dumpster and a couple of porta potties there that, you know, I guess are the facilities. But in order for any of the residents in the safe lot to have electricity, they either have to have a generator of some kind, which, you know, a lot of these people living there, including Sabrina, you know, are unemployed. Many of them suffer from addiction issues. And, you know, it's just not someplace that even looked to be remotely safe.
How did Sabrina describe it?
She described it that she had an RV, and she talked about, you know, how they were able to park there with permits so that they didn't have to worry about getting towed. And she just talked about the RV being her own little home. She never described the conditions. She talked about having friends close by. She didn't explain to me exactly what the safe zone, I don't think she even called it that. She just called it an RV park.
Tommy, you talked at the beginning a little bit about Sabrina's family experience and how she particularly took your separation and your guys' marriage particularly hard and difficult. And I admire your reflection and introspection in that manner. Have you guys had any time to think about the city or the state's role in this issue of homelessness and addiction? And if anything, what do you think is within their power to change or would be most effective?
Well, thanks for asking that question. And, you know, I have. When the newspaper reached out to us last week, that's when I read the story that preceded our story. And I started to learn of the political climate surrounding this issue of the homeless and the addiction issue. And Mayor Murray, and I believe it's Mayor Durkin now, it was called a failed initiative, I believe it was. But, you know, at the end of the day, we all have responsibility. It's not just a family's responsibility. The family has the first responsibility. But when people, and I mean people, I don't mean homeless people, because homeless people are people, they're humans, and they're citizens of the community that they live in, no matter their social status. And it's also the city of Seattle, it's the city of Spokane, it's every city's responsibility and accountability to make sure that they do everything within their means to try to preserve the safety for people, not just people that have houses, to promote the health and welfare of these people, you know, for addicted and homeless, whether it's shelters or homeless services of whatever kind, you know, treatment programs for addiction, and to funnel as, and I know money's tight, but to funnel as much money as possible into these things. You know, the thing I'm struggling with the most is why she was on the street for 8 years and didn't have an option for a real house, even if it was this tent encampment that I've read about that was supposedly just on the horizon. Beyond a city, all people have a responsibility. They say it's the addict's fault. Now, addicts make choices, but we all make choices. But when we lose control, you know, the compassion of a society and what makes a society and government, in my opinion, is how we take care of those people that cannot always take care of themselves. And I think in this case, and probably many other cases, I think society, the public, and the city failed miserably.
Would you have supported if the city, if they had mandated her get treatment, if they had forced her into some sort of rehab facility?
Oh, yes, by all means.
I would have supported it. My concern there, just from the addiction standpoint, is I know that, you know, if a person doesn't want to accept the treatment, that, I mean, ultimately, that's going to be a key factor, but certainly I support that kind of thing.
And you guys, you went the tough love route, and that's a common route for a lot of people who are dealing with a family member or a loved one who is dealing with addiction. Do you regret making that choice?
I do.
I do as well.
Every day now.
What would you have done differently?
I would have sought out a therapist. I would have sought out, you know, you able to utilize school counseling. I would have reached out to, you know, maybe places like the United Way. And, you know, they have the shelter homes here just to get ideas for how to move forward with this kind of thing. And like I said earlier, the naivety that I exhibited then, you know, we're paying for now, and Sabrina paid the highest price. And, yeah.
Kelly, anything to add to that?
Those are my regrets.
There's a lot of advice on, you know, it's a fine line between enabling someone when you have a child who's addicted and giving them support. And, yeah, I mean, Tommy and I both feel that we failed her. And no matter any advice that someone gave us who would tell us, well, there's nothing you can do. Well, there had to have been something we could have done. And that's something that I know that I will live with the rest of my life.
Well,
wondering what could I have done to help her more.
Kelly and Tommy, thank you so much for making the time for us. I can't comprehend or possibly understand the gravity of the loss that you're suffering right now. But thank you for your courage. Thank you for your bravery. Thank you for telling your daughter Sabrina's story. And it sounds like you might be religious people, and I firmly believe that with death there can be resurrection. And I know the very fact that you're talking about your story and your experiences can bring life to other families in the area and help people who are going through something similar that you guys are. So I just want to admire you for that. And thank you so much for making the time, and may you find peace and rest somehow amidst this tragedy.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Blessings to you guys, and our heartfelt condolences. It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory today. When we come back, we'll welcome Chris Sullivan, Sully, into the studio. We'll talk about a number of updates to traffic projects going on all around the Puget Sound. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Dory Monson Show podcast, brought to you by Industrious Office. If you are on the search for your business's next home, there's simply no hotter place in the country than downtown Seattle right now. I went on a tour with Emily at Industrious Office. It's an amazing workspace right on 6th and Lenora in the heart of all that Seattle has to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com/Cairo or call Emily to schedule a tour. Mention Cairo, receive your first month lease for free.
Hey there, you're listening to Dory. Did you know that your customers do too? Why don't you advertise here? Give me a call and I'll help you out. Tina Sorensen, General Sales Manager for Kiowa Radio, 206-726-6819.
It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory today. Don't fret, he'll be back soon. All right, joined now by Seattle's greatest traffic man, Chris Sullivan. Thanks for meandering into the studio here. Lots to talk about on a busy day.
I wasn't sure you were introducing me, but I take it. I like it. I'll take it.
The self-deprecating Sully.
I don't have any
He knows his goodie, but
intros.
He likes to stay humble.
Absolutely.
That's how his fans like him. Imagine if he were boastful.
Your reputation precedes you.
I'm like Kendrick Lamar, who just won a Pulitzer, right.
Okay.
I believe.
How about this?
For humble.
Take 10 seconds. Talk some smack about Tracy Taylor.
No, I can't. Tracy Taylor's the best. She is so good. She knows the roads better than I do, actually.
Kiss up. I want there to be a rivalry.
I don't know how she works a split shift doing every day from us in the afternoon at Cairo TV in the morning. She works so hard.
She's doping.
All right, let's get rid of the positivity here. I want to ask you, Chris, about SR-167 to Tacoma. 30 years in the making, and now Pierce County only needs to wait 11 more years and a few more billion dollars?
Yeah, pretty much. For people who are transplants to the region, which is most of us, it seems like you probably think, why did we stop the freeway in the middle of Puyallup? Why doesn't 167 go all the way to I-5? It seems to make sense that if we're going around the region, you would end up at I-5. And 30 years ago, when they built, they just stopped. They said, no, we're not going to finish it. And the money dried up, and so it stopped in Puyallup. And so now they are in the process of finishing 167, getting it all the way over to I-5. It's called the Gateway Project. It's something that's going to start construction next year, and it's got several components. Not only is it going to finish the 4 miles between Puyallup and I-5, it's then going to have a new interchange there at I-5, and then the road's going to continue, and they're going to extend what at that point would be Highway 509 and drive it all the way into the existing 509 at the Port of Tacoma, so that trucks will actually have a way to get from a freeway or get from the port to a freeway directly instead of having to drive through the streets of North Tacoma or at that point Fife to get onto I-5. They'll have a direct route from the Port of Tacoma up over I-5 and 167 up the valley. Then they could take I-18 over to I-90, give them a direct access into the road. So it's not only are we extending 167, but then we're expanding 509. The Gateway Project also extends 509 up near the SeaTac Airport area, which will provide a south entrance and exit from the airport. So people coming up from Pierce County won't have to drive all the way around and come in from the north. So those projects are all coming up, but they're not going to be done until 2030. So there's going to be a ton of work left to be done, and they're going to be tolled facilities,
Chris,
as well.
You mess with my mind because you talk about these stories with such enthusiasm, and you give off such an air of positivity. But it's 11 more years, $2 billion. They're going to get done a third of a mile per year. On time and under budget, you think?
Well,
can people expect anything else?
Well, let's face it, the $2 billion also includes that part up near SeaTac. So you're not just getting the 4 miles between Puyallup and I-5. This also includes the component up near SeaTac. So you get a little bit more bang than you think for your buck. But either way, it's a lot of money, and it's going to take a long time. But
Why so long?
Well, because they've got to build a bunch of interchanges. I mean, they got to build new overpasses, tear down overpasses. I mean, if we were just laying 4 miles of pavement and just cutting it through there, it would be kind of easy. But the problem with the area, too, is it's environmentally sensitive. And as we know, in the state of Washington, the environmental regulations for construction are so extreme that so much of the projects that we pay, the price tag of projects we pay, goes into that environmental impact.
Is there like a rare bird around there or something?
Well, you never know. I mean, I hope they don't run into something that they weren't expecting. But there, you know, we have fish passage and all sorts of, you know, streams and things like that. We're running through different land there. And I mean, it's important to protect that. But most people would agree outside of the Department of Transportation or others that our regulations are pretty extreme and they jack the prices up unnecessarily. So when you can build a freeway in Florida or Arizona, it costs a heck of a lot cheaper.
I'm kind of okay with not being lumped in with those two states.
Well, I was just thinking of areas that have a lot of room to grow. Arizona, especially, you can just keep building and sprawling out all you want. But we don't do that here, for good or for bad. But that's one of the reasons why these prices cost so much.
Wanted to pivot now and ask you about the meters that are beginning on Mercer Street. I think today.
Yes.
On its surface, it seems a little arbitrary to me, like WashDOT is trying to appear that they're staying busy and doing something. But is it going to alleviate any traffic? What's the reasoning behind it? And is the reasons that WashDOT gives, are they to be believed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Bottom line is yes. Now, the reason the Mercer on and off ramps are the on ramps there to I-5, one of the biggest intersections left in the state that didn't have ramp metering already. And the reason they waited until Seattle finished the Mercer widening project, because they didn't want to be doing multiple things at once. So they waited for Seattle to finish the Mercer widening, and then they installed these ramps. And what these ramps, once you realize what they're supposed to do, it kind of makes sense, even though part of the answer, which we'll get to in a minute, doesn't make any sense at all to me, is it's designed to fix I-5. It's designed to ease the flow onto I-5 so that I-5 gets better. And they think with this metering, they will be able to get 3-5% more throughput on I-5 where Mercer joins in. Now, the part that I think is kind of silly is when they say, well, this isn't going to impact Mercer at all. I'm like, really? You're going to put another set of signals on Mercer and it's not going to make Mercer any worse?
Right.
Well, the answer is, it can't get any worse. That's what the state and the city says, is it's so bad
not
now.
Not noticeably. I'm sure over time you could study and see that you spend whatever percentage more time on Mercer, but you're really not going to notice. It's going to be just as frustrating as always.
Exactly. Right. One of the good things about this project, or the ramp metering, is if you're trying to go onto southbound I-5, you now actually have three lanes to queue up. When those lights are operating, what is now the shoulder, when the lights are not active, because normally you have two lanes that merge into one once you try to go southbound, you'll actually have a third lane to queue up. So that means there'll actually be a little bit more capacity after you get through the signal at Fairview. You, there'll be three lanes for you to be able to queue up, and you go lane one, two.
People
three.
Don't know that though.
No, well, people, and even this morning, I noticed the lights actually went active in the northbound direction. To go northbound on I-5. And people are so used to getting over into that right hand lane, because when the express lanes aren't open, like they aren't in the morning, you have to get over because that left lane turns into the ramp that gets you into the express lanes. Well, the two ramp meters are actually before that express lane entrance. You can use that left lane. When I saw it go active this morning, I saw everybody merge into the right, and there was this big, long strip of pavement open on the left-hand lane. You can use both lanes when those ramp meters are active, because you won't automatically be forced into the express lanes.
Is there a sign that could remedy that?
Yeah, they put in new signs, okay, actually, that say both lanes open, lights are active. They're telling you that it's coming up. That was one of the problems we had during the testing phase. Drivers didn't really realize that, so they've added some signage to make sure that drivers know that they can they have an option there to fill in that space and to use the ramp meters as designed.
Chris, are you a hopeful guy?
Yeah, most of the time.
I get that sense from you, but it's hard for me to look at the situation, read all these stories about these projects that just go on and on. And again, to me, it appears like they're staying busy, but I don't see a real cohesive, cogent plan that's taken place, or for the influx of humanity that has hit this area. I feel like the philosophy of Seattle leadership is we're making it up as we go along.
Well, Seattle leadership, that is true. But remember, these projects are state projects, the state DOT. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got to understand that SDOT is different than WashDOT, though they do work together. Mm-hmm. They're different entities with different ideals and philosophies.
Who's better?
Well, lately, it's certainly been the state. I mean, because
you hate congestion pricing.
Well, I do hate congestion pricing, yes, because I think
because you're selfish.
No, because it targets the poor, unfortunately. And it really means that people who can't afford to live in Seattle but have to work here are going to be taxed to go to work, which is ridiculous. And also, it won't work
tax
in this
to use
city.
Roads that are otherwise free.
No, well, they'll be taxed to use to get to their office, which is different. And the people who say it's going to work
for the roads that they use.
No, they already are with the gas tax and with their state taxes and with the taxes that go to the roads that we pay through the counties as well. That's already paying for that. And the reason why congestion pricing will not work in this area, and everyone says, oh, well, it works in Europe. The three places that have it right now all have
I don't
transit
compare it to
systems
Europe. Yeah,
that
that's
work.
Not fair.
It's totally bogus when they say
and,
that.
And just their the Stockholm's attitude towards cars, Singapore's attitude towards
in
cars.
London?
And London.
And London's
it's
traffic
than
has
here.
Gone back up, too, since they added it. It went
because
down dramatically, then it
again,
went
but
back
Again, you're talking about a city that's experiencing tremendous amounts of growth.
Just and like it's we are.
Exactly. The problem here with congestion pricing is that while that's being implemented, we still aren't having enough alternative means
exactly.
of transportation.
There's no way
place.
To do it. And the congestion pricing just hurts, you know, people who can't afford it the way I see it. But, you know, that's an entirely different issue.
And lastly, lots of deliberations about tolling in the 99 tunnel. What
yes.
can you tell us about that?
Well, today they've been meeting all day today talking about how they're going to finally dial in what the exact price is going to be to use the 99 tunnel.
You know what
tunnel.
The price is going to be? More.
Well, right now they're working on anything from $1 to $2.50 each way. It's going to be variable pricing like we have on 520. So different times of day, it's going to be a different cost. And they haven't set the price yet. They're talking about it today, what they're going to finalize. They're expecting to make that decision August, September frame. They might move it up a little bit. Bottom line is the state legislature, when they approved the 99 tunnel, they said $200 million of this $3 plus billion project are going to have to come from tolls. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality. It's just going to be how much it's going to cost. And they're talking about it again today as they finalize what that price is going to be.
Let's wrap it up. Chris Sullivan, thanks so much for taking the time. Read his piece up at MyNorthwest.com right now about SR-167 to Tacoma. You're a fine fellow, Chris. Thanks for stopping
by. Thank you. I'm glad to be here, gentlemen.
It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory today. Stick around. We'll be right back. Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns in for Dory Monson today. Zach, did you attend university anywhere?
I attended several universities.
Really?
Yeah, I took a little while. I took my time in graduating, and I didn't care for the first university that I went to, and they mm-hmm. didn't care for me, so we parted ways.
Amicably?
Tried again, rebuilt my GPA at a community college, and finally got my degree.
Did you bounce around so much because you were looking to take a fat studies program?
No, but I took a lot of worthless classes.
Okay, that's what I'm getting at. So Washington State University has quietly discontinued a, quote, fat fashion class, mm-hmm. which, according to its teacher, Debbie Crystal, was aimed at exploring weight-based oppression as a social justice issue with other systems of oppression based on gender, race, class, age, sexual orientation, and ability. Mm-hmm. My first hot take from a story like this is classes like this are why parents are more and more looking for alternate options post high school for their kids, because this is exhibit A that more and more our universities are turning into, like these left wing social justice centers looking okay. for any and all victim groups to bring to the forefront and talk ad nauseum about them. And if you're at a fat fashion studies class, there's really no real-world application once you complete that credit, other than you become more obnoxious at social gatherings and family get-togethers because you get to talk about fat oppression.
Do you not think that people are biased against because of their weight?
Well,
and they absolutely are. I took much worse classes than this. My freshman year, and this is going back to the 90s, I don't know when you think these universities started becoming left-wing bastions. I mean, we could probably go back to the 50s and 60s for that. The movie PCU itself is, what, 22 years old. Mm-hmm. I took a class called Beer and History. Beer and History. That was it. It was fascinating about learning when the first brew was made. You know, it predates Egyptian times. It was great. It was interesting. There is that argument that there's education for the sake of education. Here's where I'll agree with you and say that argument is starting to fall flat.
Mm-hmm.
Because there... it can be great to get educated on something or to see a new perspective, but not at $6,000 a credit.
Right. That's exactly right. I can speak about this topic because at once upon a time, I was about 330 some pounds. Mm-hmm. And so according to many progressives, I can speak my truth about this.
Well, I have a lot of friends that are fat. So according to conservatives, I can also speak with some truth on this issue.
Well, not if you've experienced it, Zach. You have nothing to say about it if it's not your truth. If it's someone else's truth, you just have to shut up and listen, right?
The conservative argument of personal responsibility? You chose to become fat.
So bingo. All you need to know about fat oppression is... I've long held, look, my biggest vice is an addiction to food, right? So when someone meets me, mm-hmm. they go, that person has no self-control. And they are absolutely right. And I'm not going to play the victim. I am a result of my own decisions. Now, I once lost 140 pounds when I took personal responsibility. I'm up about 60, 70 now. So I've always gone that roller coaster ride. But you don't need an entire semester to study this mumbo jumbo about the justice issues surrounding fat fashion?
The term, the terminology they use, and we found this on a site called CampusReform.org, whose primary purpose, the only reason they exist, is to make fun of liberalism gone amok on campus, and they do a very good job. I will grant
you that. And
there's
left-wing outlets that do the same to the right, and there's some back and forth there.
Okay, yeah. For the sake of balance, we will mention those sites that nobody goes to.
Okay. Well,
but
media matters.
There is a legitimate issue here where there is bias against people who are overweight.
You make
a snap judgment. You make mm-hmm. that decision. Okay, well, clearly this person has let themselves go. Now, because of that, some of their character has been revealed.
What are the real world effects of that?
I think it leads to, one, you have that predisposed bias, so you don't take that person as seriously because they haven't been able to take care of themselves. I think you make judgments on how well this person can perform a specific task. Does it happen all the time? No biases happen all the time, but without a doubt, it does happen. Why do you think people want to attain that look of being thin? Because thin, attractive people are simply treated better.
But it's also for personal health and getting control of your life and getting better self-esteem, knowing that you have.
But why would you need that better self-esteem?
Because when I'm at my worst, I'm sitting on the couch indulging potato chips mm-hmm. and bad television programs and horrible
just
movies.
Just potato chips? Are you not dipping them in some sort of cheese? Jack. I wonder how deep your addiction really goes.
Okay, we're up against the clock. We got to go. Man, we could have gone 10 more minutes on this. It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns. All I'll say is I won't be grieving the end of this fat fashion class at WSU. Fastest 15 coming up next.